Welcome, council. While you're setting up, just some reminders, 15 minutes each for presentation of your argument. 5 minutes is reserved, an additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use it. It's always nice to have whistleblower cases heard in this court when they're on the national news front. I'll ask our marshal to call this case for hearing.
The next case is A-19-0604, Wayne P. Stevens, appellant versus State of Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, respondent.
Appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you may approach the podium.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Charles Moore. I am here on behalf of appellant Wayne Steffens, the plaintiff in the lower court action. We are here today on appeal from a 1202 grant for a motion to dismiss on Mr. Steffens' whistleblower claim. The Minnesota whistleblower claim has three elements: protected conduct, adverse action, and a causal connection. Only the first element is at issue in the lower court and here on appeal. So at base, the question for the court is whether or not Mr. Steffens has sufficiently alleged protected conduct under the Act. The district court found that he didn't. We aver that he has. We believe the district court erred fundamentally in three ways in applying the wrong standards to assessing Mr. Steffens' claim. He has, although we believe the district court recognized that Minnesota applies notice pleading and the requisite standards in assessing a 1202E motion, when it came to the actual application of those standards, we believe it has fundamentally erred. On the notice pleading standard, the law simply requires that Mr. Steffens provide the Department of Natural Resources, DNR, with the requisite legal theories, to put it on notice of what the legal theories it is bringing in this action. And in particular to this case, what was the protected conduct at issue? Specifically, what were his reports? Of particular note are paragraphs 21 through 31 of his complaint. These are the paragraphs in which he has laid out what were the protected reports he made. He alleges three separate protected reports, two occurring in October of 2014 and a third occurring in December of 2014. The district court specifically highlighted them as paragraphs 21, 24, and 27. The district court also recognized, now in those paragraphs, Mr. Steffens has stated who he talked to, specifically different individuals and human resources, that on a general date, not a specific date, but a general date, and that the issue that was violated, specifically their use of the temporary appointment was a violation, the use of the emergency appointment was a violation of the rules and regulations around temporary appointments.
Now, on that point, Mr. Moore, do you agree that if it wasn't a violation of the law, your client's claim fails?
If the
DNR?
Yes.
Yes. If they didn't violate, the temporary appointment or the
appointment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Glavine.
I was wondering whether you're talking about the emergency appointment or temporary
appointment. Both.
Okay.
If they didn't violate either one, in the way they hired your client, then your claim fails, right?
At base, any whistleblower claim that doesn't implicate a violation of law would fail. So at a very...
Kratzer is the law. Did I pronounce that right?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't know the correct pronunciation. But Kratzer...
So how did the agency violate either the temporary or emergency appointment procedures?
In this instance, and remarkably, this is where paragraph 30 comes into play so critically, is that the district court recognized that in paragraph 30 of Mr. Steffens' complaint, he has stated facts that would implicate a violation, particularly of the emergency appointments. The rule adopted is 3,900, 8,200. And in there, it says the DNR has discretion to make an appointment, but so long as it meets a unique and immediate need.
For the agency?
For the agency, correct. Okay. We've never taken issue that the need belongs somewhere else. Now, but the district court in recognizing that paragraph 30 has Mr. Steffens' alleged facts which would implicate a violation of that law. So under the facts, and as alleged in Mr. Steffens' complaint, there are facts sufficient to implicate a violation of law. Where the district court...
Because you're saying the agency did not have a unique or immediate need in hiring Mr. Steffens.
Exactly. Okay. It, for purposes of the district court's motion and here on appeal, it is presumed that the hiring of Mr. Steffens on the emergency appointment was simply a continuation of the work done on his temporary appointment. The temporary appointment has a temporal limitation. They're only allowed 12 months within a 24-month span. He hit that limit in October, and then a week later was rehired to do the same work through the use of the emergency appointment. It is that act which Mr. Steffens has alleged and reported to HR was the violation of the state's law. Now, the district court found that in paragraph 30 he had alleged facts and so that would implicate a violation there. What the district court said is he didn't allege reporting those facts. Now, we believe this indicates a second error that the district court made. Simply, in order for that opinion to hold together, the district court had to infer he did not report those facts. Now, read as a whole, the complaint reads, particularly around these reports, reads almost as a narrative flashback, somewhat bookended on paragraphs 20 and 32. Mr. Steffens is discussing a conversation he's having with a superior in 2015. In which he references these reports. He then flashes back does a narrative flashback in paragraph 21, discusses all the reports, and then flashes forward again to the 2015. So it is the entirety of these paragraphs which forms the discussion of these reports. Now, the district court said because he put it in paragraph 30 and not paragraph 21, 24, or 27, it doesn't meet the pleading standard. We believe that that is simply incorrect. And a review of the complaint itself actually indicates that Mr. Steffens laid out the discussion of these reports in multiple paragraphs. For example, paragraph 22 is the response from HR after he makes his alleged report in paragraph 21. The same is true of paragraph 25 as a response to his allegation in paragraph 24. So what he has done is he's essentially said, on these days, I said to HR, you violated the state rules and regulations. They then responded negatively. Here is the rule I believe you violated, and here is why I believe you violated it. We believe that is more than sufficient to meet the notice pleading standard to put DNR on notice of what the legal theory was. What was it Mr. Steffens was bringing forward? He was bringing forward a whistleblower claim for making reports on these days and these issues. Now, again, the district court had to infer, it made a second error, and it had to infer that paragraphs 21, 24, and 27 were verbatim recitations of the entirety of his reports in order to say that what was said in paragraph 30 was not part of this report. We believe that is a second inference error that the court made, again, drawing the inferences in favor of the defendant instead of the plaintiff, as it is to do. We believe the court made a third fundamental error in its standards applied in this case, and that is a 1202E motion should only be granted if it is evident that if it is clear there's no evidence which could be brought to bear to support his claim. Again, the district court said the facts as alleged in paragraph 30 would implicate a violation of law. And if it does, then his reports are protected conduct. If that is in fact the case, there's nothing in there to say he did not report that. Again, it's not alleged that he did not report it. And evidence could be brought forth which would support it. Namely, Mr. Steffens could have testified to it. HR could have testified to this fact. In fact, in oral argument, Mr. Steffen said he could bring forth additional, he had additional evidence to bring forth. He had, apparently he has emails from HR which allegedly support all this. With that in hand, the district court should have recognized evidence could be brought to bear which could support his these underlying claims, making them protected conduct.
If it was an illegal act.
Part
of the DNR. It all hinges back to that.
The district court recognized it wasn't, that these would, in fact, be an illicit act.
Are you saying that the court really recognized that there was an illegal act here or the potential illegal act, but decided this case on the lack of a report of that detail being in a report of some kind?
Even more nuanced than that, Your Honor. The district court recognized that if those facts were true, it would implicate a violation of law. This is the second to last paragraph of the district court's opinion. It would implicate a violation of law, but that he didn't allege reporting those facts. And that's what the district court's opinion hinged on, was the fact that it was not reported. It recognized that if those facts were in fact true, that this was nothing more than a continuation of his work from the temporary position just used through the emergency appointment.
Well, what did you allege as to reporting?
I'm sorry.
What did you allege as to reporting?
Specifically, it was happening over a series of paragraphs, but if I may draw the court's attention, it can be found at paragraph 30, which is page 14 of the appellant's addendum. Specifically, he alleged reporting that the remaining work could have been done after the unlimited position had started. The district court found that this statement was sufficient. In its opinion, it said this statement, that these facts would have been sufficient to implicate a violation of law, but that the failure was that he failed to allege reporting it. Our position is that he didn't need to allege that this statement was made in the report, rather read as a whole, as the complaint must be, that this statement, it is a very reasonable inference, this statement was made to HR. At the very least, evidence could be brought forth to support this, that he did make this statement to HR. And that, for that, we find to be, again, the third standard error that the district court made. Setting aside all of these errors in the application of standard, even if the district court were to still dismiss, we feel it made a fundamental error in not granting Mr. Steffen's leave to amend. Now this, it should be said that
The district court said, what do you want in the amendment? The answer is, I don't know.
He said he didn't know what,
I was paraphrasing, but that's how I read it.
Absolutely, he did say he did not know at that time, but
fault the trial court for not allowing an amendment when you ask what is the amendment and the response is, well, I'm not sure. The court assess whether that amendment ought to be granted if it doesn't even know what the amendment is.
I would aver, Your Honor, that as we said, paragraph 30, the court recognized that facts could be brought forth if they had been alleged. The deficiency was in the allegations of report, not that the facts didn't exist. So the court could have recognized that had he been able to allege that the facts of paragraph 30 were in fact stated to HR, did he say to HR, this is just a continuation, I'm doing the same work today I was doing 2 weeks ago, that the court should have recognized that amendment may not have been futile in this instance, that there could have been facts brought forth. Additionally, at oral argument, when pressed on the matter, Mr. Steffens was saying, I believe what I have said is sufficient, which we believe it is, but that if I need to, I can bring forth more evidence, including, as he said, emails from HR, which could support this claim. This, again, should have put the court on notice that, of course, that we do have, as you ask, how is the court to know if he doesn't know exactly what the amendments are? We believe it is too high a burden to ask a litigant to be able to recite their amendment there and then, but he didn't make the court aware that I do have additional facts, I do have additional evidence I can bring forth at this time to support these claims. Now, we believe that that these fundamental errors in the application of the pleading standard are in each instance reversible error by the district court. We have raised a number of other issues. I do see that I am running short on time. I am happy to address anyone if the court so desires.
You'll have your rebuttal opportunity. Absolutely. Thank you, Ms. Moore.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Hillary Taylor, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, here today representing the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Your Honors, DNR did exactly what it had the discretion to do according to the legislature and under MMB's personnel administrative rules. It appointed appellant to an emergency appointment at the end of the term of his temporary appointment to meet its unique and immediate needs. I will address three reasons here today as to why the district court should be affirmed. First, because the plain language of the relevant statute and rule gave DNR the broad discretion to meet its needs in this way. Second, the district court correctly dismissed appellant's amended complaint because the facts of his reports, accepted as true, would not violate any law. And third, his new proposed standard has already been in part dismissed or rejected by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Kratzer v. Welsh Companies and is an overbroad expansion of the Whistleblower Act. Before I turn to my first
Ms.
point,
Taylor, and I appreciate articulating that framework, I do have a question. So if in any of these three reports he had said, I believe the DNR is violating the law dealing with emergency appointments because I am not fitting any unique or immediate need they have, would that report, even under your theory of the case, be sufficient to state a whistleblower complaint?
No, it wouldn't, Your Honor.
Why not?
For two reasons. One, what you stated, if it were alleged, would truly be a legal conclusion. It takes the phrase from the rule itself and would import itself into this hypothetical complaint. But the second reason, if we look at to what a unique and immediate needs requires, it is broad discretion left up to an appointing agency to be able to look at what they have going on and say, for 45 days, we need somebody in this role. And as you've alleged, nothing in that particular pattern would go to show that within their broad discretion, that was being met by that particular appointment.
What if he had said, I believe the DNR is violating the Emergency Powers Act because I do not fill a unique or immediate need, and I just gave the HR person $5,000. Would that do it?
I believe it could, but not for the reasons
that Mr.
Stevens...
Well, you know, I believe it could, too.
The allegation you have there would be most definitely a potentially illegal act. So that would be protected, but not for the theory that Mr. Stevens is alleging, Your Honor. If we turn to what the actual language of the statute and rule is before us, we could see that appellant misinterprets the broad discretion DNR has to meet its needs through non-competitive appointments. If we look first, just maybe generally taking a step back as to what civil service is, we often think of it as competitive, how people would go forward and kind of compete for various state positions. But there's another bucket that state agencies have to be able to meet their needs, and it's for these temporary periods, and these are the non-competitive appointments. Two were used here in the particular case before you. And in two, based on the language of the statute and then MMB's promulgated rule, we can see that DNR used both for the purposes that they are there for, but also within the primary definition and then the primary limitation of those non-competitive appointments, which is their limited duration. If I were to turn just briefly for you to the Minnesota rule for emergency appointments, which would touch on what he's alleging here today, we can see the language says, in Minnesota Rule 3900-8200, an appointing authority may make emergency appointments to meet unique and immediate needs. The appointing authority may appoint any person considered qualified. Appointments are limited to 45 working days in any 12-month period by, and then it states the statute at issue. The reasonable interpretation from the plain language of the rule is that MMB did not intend to describe all potential emergency situations that could apply to appointing agencies. However, the phrase unique and immediate needs imports the exercise of the agency's broad discretion, which occurred here. The district court was correct, just from here, interpreting the statute and the rule to conclude that, and I quote from the court order at page 5, personnel rules do not prohibit making emergency appointments that essentially continue an employee's duties under a previous temporary appointment. Your Honor, there's also no explicit bar also against restricting agencies from making successive non-competitive appointments.
Well, that's all true if we agree with your interpretation of the statute that this is a unique need for DNR and an immediate need. On the other hand, it just doesn't feel right. And, you know, part of plaintiff's complaint is saying it is mischief to do this because, I mean, you don't get your employment benefits. You kind of fill a gap. You really can manipulate that rule to DNR's advantage, to the detriment of the employee. And I think that's what we're getting at here, is that it just doesn't feel right.
Right. If I could turn to appellant's complaint, maybe to touch on that, how it feels.
Well, he does in his complaint.
In his complaint, though, they also note that this emergency appointment, in particular, they state, was in order to finish remaining work for the season. If you look at paragraph 6 and at paragraph 30, it talks about remaining work. Now, DNR's work is inherently at times seasonal, and it's hard to look at that and to think that somehow him continuing on his duties would not meet within DNR's discretion their unique and immediate needs for the agency. It is, in fact, something that they can see that there was remaining work to be done just a minute ago. There is, in attempt to look at the rule itself and the statute, an idea that each agency has discrete needs, and it has needs that may be met within just a temporary time frame. We're not putting somebody in an emergency appointment for a year. We're not putting somebody in an emergency appointment for a year from now even. That would probably be a violation of the immediate need element of that phrase.
So you think the time limits that are on there kind of undoes the harsh application?
It does, Your Honor. And at the end of the day, once...
You can't keep having an emergency every 45 days because then it's not really an emergency.
Right. Okay. And I think that you can see the legislature and then MMB's guide...
Failure to plan is not my emergency.
Right, that comment phrase, it could show for in the idea that 45-day window can't be duplicated over and over because you can only do that for 1 year. If I may turn, though, to the fact that, and my second point, as I mentioned, the district court correctly dismissed appellant's complaint because the facts in his alleged reports taken as true just would not violate the relevant law and rule that we talked about here today. I believe you heard part of the legal sufficiency standard previously. If I may just go into the full legal sufficiency standard from Kratzer and then also from Abraham versus County of Hennepin. It goes on to talk about the fact that there must be a rule or law that is implicated by an employee's complaint. It goes on to say that the employee must have reported the violation, suspected violation or planned violation in good faith. And then the third part of the legal sufficiencies test is to go on to say, and assuming the facts, this is a quote, have occurred as reported, whether those facts would constitute a violation of law or rule adopted pursuant to law. Here we've seen the district court take a look at plaintiff's whole complaint. Rather, even though it pulled out certain paragraphs for purposes of its brief order, it examined the full complaint. And then it applied a legal sufficiency standard that was talked about by the Minnesota Supreme Court in both Kratzer and then in both Abraham versus County of Hennepin. We can look ourselves even at the three reports that appellant alleges. And we can see that appellant made no report of exceeding the 45-day limit under the emergency appointment. We can see that there's no statute or rule that prohibits DNR from employing a person in an emergency appointment after that person has exhausted the separate bucket of the temporary appointment, so long as it meets the agency's unique and immediate needs. And we can also see here that from the plain language of the rule, it imports agency discretion. For it to know what its employment needs may be, how it can best meet that perhaps in that limited window of 45 days. And even in the midst of these reports, we can see that DNR interviewed plaintiff for another position and then hired him before he made his third report. And then he started that seasonal unlimited position in the spring the following year. It's not something that was not heard by DNR. It's just something that it could not imagine as an employer to be a violation of its broad discretion per the statute and the rules. And the district court agreed with that argument. Your Honor, to the extent, I think there was a little bit of a focus on paragraph 30 of appellant's amended complaint. I would state two things as to maybe what the district court...
Well, that's probably because he had a lawyer at that point.
Well... Yeah, truly. If, as the pro se appellant, though, noted, or previously was pro se plaintiff and then here today represented, noted that paragraph 30 could go on to at least allow them to cross the barrier of that 1202 standard, I would state that paragraph 30 states a legal conclusion. It actually states that Stephen's emergency appointment, and I quote, was identical in every tangible way. The work... And I'm going to skip ahead. There was no unique or immediate need.
That's what you're referring to as a legal conclusion?
Yes, Your Honor. There was no unique or immediate need.
What about the remaining work could have been done after the unlimited position started? In other words, could have been done next year.
Right. And that is a fact, perhaps, but the court took that and examined that. And the idea, though, that maybe Mr. Stephens, admitting that there is remaining work to be done, could allege that is still not alleging a violation, necessarily, of the emergency appointment. There's still work to be done. The agency, in its broad discretion, sees work that could be done now for this 45 more day under emergency appointment. But also moving on, within looking at the broader complaint, as appellant asks us to do, if you look up at paragraph 28 and 29, and then jump over 30 to 31, we see an examination of more legal conclusions, which the court is not required or bound to see as something that it should put forward in making its decision. And the court read that for what it was. We have seen his reports in 21, 23, and 27, but we also see his own legal conclusions. And housed within that, the legal conclusion can't push him necessarily across the finish line. I see that my time is starting to wind down. If I may, turn to my third point. Appellant's proposing something new. They're proposing something somehow that is still old because it has been addressed by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Kratzer, and it's a proposal of an overbroad expansion of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. When you think about protected conduct, we think about the fact that a reviewing court must consider the fact that if he has an act that implicates a law and those facts reported as true would be a violation of the law, then we have a protected report. Third proposal would be if it implicates an ambiguous law and the facts taken as true would violate at least whatever their interpretation of that law is, then we have a protected report. Doesn't line up with how we consider a protected report to be. We may have mistake of underlying facts. They may plead something that if proven at the end of the day, maybe didn't occur, but if those facts as alleged would be a violation of the law, then we take their report as protected. Now, under their new standard, you could have a potential mistake of law plus a mistake of facts, equal a protected report, and that just simply can't be the case. Kratzer stated at Penn Site 22 that the report, while it must implicate at least a violation of law, That does not mean, and I quote, that the reported conduct need only seem in the eyes of the employee to be lawful, even if that conduct is lawful. Similarly here, there must be facts in the report which, as alleged, if they're taken true, are an actual violation of the law. And that would be a monumental change to the Whistleblower Act if we were to take it on, because the fact that the legislature expressly stated in the whistleblower statute that it protects reports of actual, suspected, or planned violations of the law or rule ensures clarity for employers. Employers need to know what type of personnel behaviors may fall within the Whistleblower Act's protection. And this also reflects an intent, that specific phrase I read from the statute, to focus on conduct that's been clearly defined, clearly prescribed by the legislature, and then in this case, MMB is the one who promulgated the applicable rule. Your Honors, I'll conclude since I see my time is up. If there are any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but we ask that you affirm the district court's decision here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
Well, Mr. Moore, that seemed pretty convincing to me. Why is she wrong?
In short, she is.
Believe me, there's no doubt in my mind you believe that. My question is, why is she wrong?
The position put forward by the state, again, the relevant clause here, yes, the DNR has discretion. That is granted by the word may. It has the discretion to appoint these people, but it is limited in that appointment by the clause unique and immediate. Now, the position taken by DNR is that the 45-day limitation puts an end cap and therefore no mischief can be made. However, that only addresses the immediate element of it. It does not address the fact that the need must also be unique. And what the district court found was that the continuation of the work from the previous position to the emergency appointment was a violation of the law. Now, the district court did not articulate whether or not that was a violation of the unique element or the immediate element, but it appears most closely to align with a violation of the unique element, that it wasn't that the work done before and the work done after was not unique. It was simply bad HR management. They didn't get the work done in time.
But that's, it seems to me bad HR management is not illegal. And that's the one thing that's pretty clear in Kratzer, if he's, as he said, so he wouldn't have to fill out new hire paperwork. I mean, that may imply a bad faith idea to the DNR, but that's not illegal. So where in his three reports did he specifically say what they're doing was illegal? What was the illegal act they were doing? And here I'm looking at, mm-hmm. I guess it's in your brief? Yes, there you go. Pages 6 and 7, where we get into, his calls to HR, where is the illegal act that he's reporting? I mean, it says he believes the use of the emergency point was a violation of state law. So I guess the first question is, in either that section or in, and then he says again, state using the emergency point in a way was a violation of rules and regulations. I mean, in those two things, if what they were doing was not a violation, you lose, right?
On a broad scale, yes.
Yes. Well,
at a broad statement.
I would think on a limited scale too, but So the first question is what he's alleging a violation of the law? And if it isn't, then you lose. And then I'm looking, let's look at that, in the amended complaint, that's when we start talking about this, unique or immediate needs. Now, did he, and I don't want to get into this huge debate on notice pleading again. God, I'm so sick of that. It sounds like in none of these reports he used those, is it fair to say that the record that we have before us in any of his reports, he certainly didn't use those words, it would appear. He just said, is that a fair statement?
I believe that is not, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're saying I should look at this complaint, and in one of these reports to HR, he did use the magic language.
Of unique and immediate need?
Yes.
I don't believe he used the magic language of unique and immediate. We ultimately don't know because the record is yet undeveloped. One of the elements to Kratzer was
The record is, what we've got is what we've got, and this is a Rule 12, yes. And there was no amendment. So, what I'm trying to find out is where in these reports is he alleging an illegal act? If indeed it was illegal.
If I may, what he has done in the series of paragraphs is said in paragraph 21, 24, and 27, again, he has said, I talked to HR, and I said they are violating the law. He then goes on to paragraph 28 and says, here is the law I believe was violated. And then he goes on to paragraph 30 and says, here are facts that I believe indicate a violation of that law. Now, whether...
But doesn't he have to explain how the law is being violated? I mean, what are the facts? I mean, there's two issues. One is the law being violated? And second, what are the facts he's alleging as to how the law was violated? So what are the facts in any of these HR reports that he's alleging as to how the emergency and temporary appointment authority statute is being violated?
Your time has expired, but please answer the question.
The district court found that the facts articulated in paragraph 30 were sufficient to implicate a violation of the unique and immediate needs statute. That is what the district court did state. Where it found that was insufficient was on the pleading that was not alleged to have been reported. It is that connection between the facts. So to answer your question, the facts that would implicate a violation of the statute are found in paragraph 30, namely that the work was simply a continuation of what had been happening prior. Again, it was just the whether or not the court sufficiently drew these paragraphs together to meet the standards.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today and arguing in support of your briefing. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame. Thank you.